fun.
Well, our guest today is Mike Thompson, WB8ERG. He is located in Mansfield, Ohio. And I want to say welcome to QSO. Mike is also a radio engineer, from what I understand. We haven't had a chance to talk a whole lot about it, but I was just relating to him some of the changes in the radio industry. And I was telling a story here. Are you with me, Mike?
Yeah, I'm with you, Ted. One thing. Sorry, it's ERJ, Echo Radio Japan.
What did I say?
G.
G. I said G. Well, that wouldn't surprise me, because my brain has been RF'd today. I think something's.
Yeah, I know. It was a rough start here for a little bit.
Anyhow, I was telling him there's so much changes in the radio industry that if you're in the engineering end of it. The last group of stations I worked for had a habit of hiring people in that I would consider to be below entry level. And this was even true with a program director who called me on the phone one day and says, "We're off the air. We're off the air." And I thought, oh, my. So the company I was working for, the vehicle, had no radio in it. Now, understand, this is the radio engineering vehicle with no radio receiver.
Oh, wow.
You know, which is pretty typical, you know. So I go flying back to the station, but I'm dialing the transmitter up, and I got meter readings. The transmitter's on, you know. So I get back, and the first thing, I go through the back door, and I look into the rack room, and I see the modulation monitor. The meters are bobbing up and down and everything. And I thought, well, that looks like they're on the air. So I go back in the studio, and the program director says, "Oh, we're off. We're off. You know, I said, okay. And I looked over, and the meters are moving on the console. And I know we got audio on the air because I saw it in the mod monitor, you know. So I reached over to the microphone number 2, and I shut it off. And then the speakers unmuted in the studio. And he said, "What did you do? What did you do?" You know, and you wanted to say, you know, as much fun as I've made of broadcasting schools, I wanted to say, did you ever go to broadcasting school? Have you learned basics on console operation? I mean, what? You know, we'll be right back on QSO with our guest, Mike Thompson, WB8ERJ from Mansfield, Ohio, right after this. It operates 20 through 10 meters. It's stealth. It will keep up with any three-element beam and any vertical that you have on your property. But if you can't have a three-element beam or a vertical on your property, you can still have a TW2010. It is stealth. It disappears. We tried to take pictures of it, and we had to move the thing around because it hides so well. There is no compromise in performance with this antenna, and it's portable. You can take it with you on vacation. It's quite unique. They make several flavors of this antenna, however. If you want to operate 80, 40, 60, 30-meter band, it's all there. Go to their website and check it out, transworldantennas.com. That's transworldantennas.com, and check out the special pricing.
If you're the decision maker for any form of outdoor lighting, you're going to want to listen to this. The Light Pack Systems induction lights, manufactured in the USA by a severely disabled workforce, uses a unique physical principle of light generation. This lamp system is therefore classified in a new family of sources, the Light Pack induction lamp systems. Light Pack induction lighting is a breakthrough for professional, general, and special lighting applications, not only because of its high luminescence and efficiency, but especially because of its unprecedented lifetime. System lifetime is rated at 100,000 hours, or about 20 years, based on 5,000 burning hours per year. With a failure rate of less than 10%. With this unmatched durability, LightPack offers substantial savings in direct maintenance costs as well as indirect costs. Induction lighting is relatively new in the United States, but it's proven technology developed in Europe over 20 years ago. Therefore, claims of durability is based on real-world empirical data, as opposed to estimated design life provided by competitive lighting technologies such as LED. LightPack Systems was founded on the principles of green solutions for modern lighting Through strong partnerships with the U.S. military, the University of Central Florida, and several national energy service companies, LightPack offers lighting solutions that provide a better quality of light with a 66% energy savings, also lasting up to 5 times longer than standard lighting options. LightPack's quality shines through with their standard 10-year warranty on all products. Call today for your free demonstration. Go to their website, lightpacksystems.com. That's lightpacksystems.com, spelled LITEPAKSYSTEMS. Lightpacksystems.com.
If you like to travel, if you're a camper, if you'd like to take your ham radio hobby with you when you go, you need the Trans World Antennas TW2010L Backpacker Antenna. It's the same exact antenna as the TW2010 Adventurer, with the exception it's been streamlined for the person who likes to camp and travel light. It's the same rugged antenna structure as the TW2010, with the black powder coating and stealth design. We all know the TW2010 is a great permanent or portable antenna, but the TW2010L Backpacker takes portable and emergency operation to an entirely new level. It's especially suited for the amateur operator who loves backpacking, cycling, camping, and makes easy access and quick setup possible for the most extenuating emergencies. TW2010L Backpacker Antenna is available now for a limited time for only $399.95. That's right, $399.95. Pricing includes backpacker, quadra stand, carrying bag, and free shipping in the continental United States through FedEx Ground. That's transworldantennas.com. And now for a limited time, only $399.95. That's transworldantennas.com.
Here at QSO, we've got something new, and that's a prize closet. And we are in the process of filling that prize closet up. And we're going to be telling you on the air some of the items that we've got in the prize closet. If you'd like to win some of these things, we'd love to see you do that. But what you've got to do is send us an email. Go up to the website, tedrandall.com or qsoradioshow.com. And when you go to that website, just simply send us an email. Say hello. Tell us where you're listening, how the signal's coming in. If you're listening by podcast, tell us how you have joined this radio show. And then put a little note in there that says, I want to win. And we'll put your name in the hat, and we will have a drawing twice a month, and we're going to be giving away what's in our prize closet. Now, I can't tell you everything that's in there so far, but we'll be posting those items up on the website, and we'll be telling you about them on the air, but don't miss out. Send us an email, and put in that email, I want to win. And let's see who the lucky winners will be. And now back to our guest, Mike Thompson, WB8ERJ from Mansfield, Ohio, right here on QSO. But, you know, by the general manager, now understand, we had an ice storm. This was in Clarksville, Tennessee. I might as well go just say where it was. And ice had fallen off the 10-bay antenna and fell and struck the STL dish and busted the dipole just right off.
Ouch.
So the STL was down. There was no studio transmitter link. And if folks that may not know, that's what STL stands for. And that's the high-frequency transmitting receiving system that takes the signal from the studios to the transmitter site. And usually those STL dishes are mounted, you know, a good deal up in the air, depending on the distance, you know, from the station. So it was down. It was off, you know. So I told her, I said, well, I think what we'll do, we had a standby antenna. I said, I think I'll take a MARTI unit and put it on transmit here. Now, MARTI is the portable units that you use for remote broadcasting that operate on any number of frequencies that you may have assigned your license to at a radio station, but it's a remote link, so you can do remote broadcasting and whatnot. So I took the MARTI and I put it on transmit and stuck it on the MARTI receive antenna, which was mounted above the studios. Went out to the transmitter site and took a receiver and hooked it up to the spare 10 bay up there that they had, the secondary antenna. That way we get an audio path going there, even though it's mono and doesn't sound too good, but at least they're on the air. And so in the process of describing all this to her, she was like all concerned. You know, it's like, why are you doing all of this? And then she says, the classic question she asked me, she says, can't you just put on a CD? So that kind of gives you a picture Today they say that, you know, radio's in bad shape. Well, hey, you know. wonder what might be the cause of that, you know. Anyhow, but you do radio engineering, and it's interesting when I find hams that are into radio engineering, because as a rule, I think we really kind of have a better grasp of things. I think we really have a lot better handle on it. Not these other fellows that are non-hams. They're probably not shortwave listeners, so we can talk about them a little bit. We don't have to worry.
There you go.
Although we may catch a few in the podcast, so you got to watch it.
I guess we get sort of careful, yeah.
Well, tell me a little bit about your radio engineering career. I'd like to hear a little bit about that.
Well, it's basically the reason I got my job here in radio engineering was because of my ham radio license. I do have a degree in electronics engineering. It's only a 2-year, but it is a degree nonetheless. And I've had many years of experience in engineering on a manufacturing side, electronics engineering, computer programming, and such. But I've always had an insatiable curiosity, specifically with radio. And I've only been here for 5 years. We're a little nonprofit. We're in a high school. We teach high school students broadcasting. And I walked in here one day because my son was taking the radio class. And the station manager at the time, he comes around the corner, and he's just got this deer-in-the-headlight look. And I'm like, "Hi, I'm Mike Thompson. My son John is taking your class." And he's like, "Oh, hi, yeah. You know, I need to talk scheduling with you." And he's like, "Yeah." He's like, "I'm sorry." He's like, "You know, I'm really overloaded here." He says, "I've been working 14-hour days." He says, "I have all these technical issues." He says, "I have no idea what I'm doing." And I was out of a job, and, you know, my unemployment had run out, and I just walked into to this situation. And I had, once we figured out the scheduling issue, I looked at him and said, "Now, you've got technical issues." He's like, "Yeah." And I'm like, "Well, let me explain myself to you." He's like, "Okay." I'm like, "Well, I built my first radio in the 4th grade. I got my ham radio license in the 9th grade. I have an electronics engineering degree. So is there anything I can do to help you out?" And he looks at me. He's like, "You're hired." And I'm like, no. Stupid me. I'm like, no. I'll just help you out until I find a job." He's like, "No." He's like, "I'm hiring you." He's like, "You stay here. I'm going to go downstairs and talk to the people." That's how I got into broadcast engineering, if you will.
Well, that's interesting. And see, I think, you know, and we've maintained this for a long time, that amateur radio really opens a door to this kind of thing. It's a natural for it. You know?
I absolutely agree.
And I've had so many conversations with folks. Even somebody like Ronnie Millsap, who tells me that his amateur radio skills helped him tremendously in the studio to be able to understand what was going on, and also to be innovative, to try something new, you know, to be able to combine a couple technologies together that have never been put together before, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. I've been going down your list of podcasts, and I saw that. I'm like, I must listen to that one. I haven't had a chance to listen to your podcast about with Ronnie Millsap. I'm looking forward to that one for sure.
Ronnie's a good friend, but he's just an incredible human being for someone who is an unsighted person to be able to do all the things that he has done. And it's not been easy. I mean, I sit and watch him run a computer with that JAWS program, and it's absolutely incredible. I mean, he actually can do things quicker than I can. You know, I mean, he's and that's not an exaggeration, really. I mean, we've watched him, and he's just quite incredible. Matter of fact, I was on a conversation with him one day. I was on the telephone. He told me he was editing some video, and I thought, I'm not even going to ask. I don't want to ask. But
that's a concept. Yeah. Wow. Yeah, a good friend of mine in high school was blind, also a ham, and it's quite an experience to hang around with someone blind. It's amazing.
Well, I forget he's blind.
Yeah,
and I will
absolutely
do things like send pictures to him, and then after I hit the send button, it hits me, you know. And
yeah.
He told me he makes light of it, though. In some cases, he said the other day, he said that Joycey and he had replaced all their television stuff in the living room with all the new HD things, and he said he just couldn't tell any difference at all. You know, yeah. he'll do that. And actually, I'll tell you what, I shouldn't tell this story, but I'm going to. He'll probably shoot me. He actually got stopped by a police officer one time while driving a vehicle.
That's awesome.
He had some of the fellow sitting in back of him would like nudge him on the right shoulder and nudge him on the left shoulder or push in the center of his back if he needed to stop and give him all the hand signals.
That's awesome.
And so he was actually driving. And the police officer stopped them. Now, this is what I find. I've got to tell this story. Ronnie, if you're listening, you know, he gets out and he talks to this police officer. Now, of course, he probably has sunglasses on. I don't know. But anyways, they have this conversation. And the police officer, I think, asked to see his license. And Ronnie said, well, I think I left my wallet at the house or something. I don't know. But anyways, he winds up getting back in the vehicle. The officer goes back and gets in his vehicle, lets him off the hook. And Ronnie drives away.
That's just hilarious.
I thought, you know, that really ought to be in a book somewhere. I mean, that ought to be part of a story. They ought to do his life. Really, they should do his life because his life has been just incredible. It's an incredible story. You know.
That sounds like maybe something you should take on.
Well, I have done an extensive interview with him, but I'm thinking somebody ought to do a movie because it's you know, life story. A biography of his life in video because it's really he's come down an incredible path, you know. And to watch his ability now and all the skills that he's honed and how good he is at it, it's just amazing. He's producing his own podcast, incidentally. We put it up on iTunes and on Zune. If you have a chance to go to iTunes or Zune or even his website and click on the Ronnie Millsap Show, which is a new podcast series he started putting out, and it's really good. He does it all himself. He produces the whole thing.
Wow. I'll have to check that out.
The only thing I do is the RSS script and put it up on the server. So but it's amazing. It really is. It really, really is. Well, now, let's talk a little bit about ham radio. I know it's on your page, on your webpage, which is ERJ. I have my glasses off. ERJ. WB8ERJ.com.
Uh-huh.
There's a picture of you holding a Yagi antenna of some sort. You're sitting on a beach, and it says, my portable satellite station.
Yep, so that's correct.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, as you know, hams have satellites up that are in outer space, flying around, and the what they call uplink and downlink frequency are in ham bands, and it's literally a repeater that's flying through the sky, and it's great fun. You can use a handheld. That's usually what I use, is just a little HT, run 2 to 5 watts, and you just point it up at the sky. You know, whenever the satellite's going to pop up over the horizon, and it's very contest oriented. It's very helter skelter, but it's great fun.
Well, I wondered about that because I know a lot of guys are kind of you know, satellites still remain quite a mystery, you know, to them. And of course, I've never done any satellite work. Matter of fact, I picked up a dual band radio that's supposed to be designed specifically for doing satellite work. I guess it can transmit and receive simultaneously or something. I don't know.
That's not necessary, but that helps.
I've never used it like that. But there was a group here locally that really got into doing satellites for a while, and they would get on and they would talk, and they made it sound as if, and once again, I've never tried it, mostly because I've never had the time. You know, this radio show takes up an awful lot of time. I didn't realize how much time it was going to take up until I started it, you know. But and I don't get time to operate. That's one of my biggest complaints right now, is I just don't have any time. But they acted like this one fellow says, well, it's not for everybody. Not everybody can talk on satellites. He said, you got to do things. He said, when you're working satellites, you got to do things. And I thought, well, now what is it you got to do? I don't understand, because I see these guys holding these antennas in their hand and working satellites off of an HT. So why don't you take a little mystery out of this and talk to a little bit about how you go about doing it, and talk about the mechanics, because we have a lot of folks that are listening that are technicians that are listening by means of podcasts. They haven't got the slightest idea even when to start. And then we've got some old people like me that that have never done that. So Take us right from the very raw beginning. What does a person do that wants to, you know, wants to make a QSO on a satellite?
Okay, well, first of all, I'm an old person like you. I might even be older. I don't know, but being the big kid at heart, you know, it's all fun. But basically, I personally find it actually quite easy to work the satellites. There's a lot going on. That's kind of the downside. But you basically, like I said, you point your antenna at the horizon where the satellite's going to pop up over the horizon, and you've got to deal with what they call Doppler. And it's just like, you know, when you're sitting at a railroad crossing and you hear the train whistle coming at you, and then as it goes by, the frequency drops. Well, as the satellite's coming at you, instead of listening on the standard frequency, you got to listen 5 to 10 kilohertz higher. And then as it is up overhead, you got to move your frequency down a little bit. You know, and then as you're going away, you've got to tune down on your receive. Transmit's just the opposite. And that's a nice thing to take. Like, I just use a VX5, an old Yaesu VX5, and it doesn't do the full duplex, which is what your transmitter does. But I just pre-program in, like, 10 channels for the satellite that's got all the Doppler calculated in, and it's just a matter of, you know, when the receive starts sounding funny, I just go down another channel. So that's all taken care of for me.
Now, when you do that, does it also then raise the transmit?
Yeah. But that's just a matter of pre-programming each one of the 8 or 10 channels that you choose to do.
Just like a repeater pair is what you're saying. Is you have that
exactly. Set. So you just got 8 or 10 repeater pairs that are just, you know, 5 kilohertz off, going up or down depending on whether you're on the uplink or downlink, and that's all you do.
Okay. Now, when this thing comes over the horizon, or over the horizon, how do you orient? How do you orient your antenna? I mean, how do you follow this thing? Because seeing you holding this thing in your hands. So.
That's the beauty of it. You're holding it in your hand, and so you can make a real quick snap decision as to whether you're horizontal or whether you're vertical polarization. You just rotate it, and you can hear it. You know, usually there's other hams on the channel that are talking, and you know you can rotate it, you know, one way or the other, and you can find the strong signal, and then you do your best you can to wait for a lull in the action, and you just drop your call in there real quick. And usually you'll put your grid square in there. You know, we have Ida A, and we have worked all states, and, well, another one that they have is grid square. And, you know, we hams like to collect things, and so grid square is one of the ones that, you know, satellite operators like to collect. So you throw your call out there with a grid square, and, you know, all of a sudden you're rare DX. Really quite fun.
Okay, now, how big a window is it? I mean, when you're following this thing, I assume that you point at the horizon, but you have to keep raising the altitude of the antenna
as
the satellite passes over.
Yep.
So what is a typical window for the thing to come to the horizon, go as far as the zenith or up wherever it crosses? I'm sure it doesn't cross exactly at the zenith, but it crosses somewhere, and then goes back to the other horizon from horizon to horizon if you make an effort of following it manually and holding the antenna relatively in the right spots. How long do you have, you figure?
Well, one of the variables you have is like you say, the zenith point is not necessarily over your head. A lot of times it's, maybe 50 degrees above vertical is your horizon. And of course, that's going to determine how much window you have. But if you have a shot that's coming at you and basically going to go directly overhead, you've got about 10 minutes.
I was wondering how long a conversation you could engage in. So this is not for long-winded people, then, is what you're saying.
No, it's very contest style because, you know, it is a repeater, and there's one channel. And you've got, in satellite lingo, it's called a footprint. You know, if you were the satellite looking down on the Earth, what is seen from the satellite is called a footprint. You got a repeater that can cover 2,000 miles. So there's a lot of people on there that want to talk. So it's just a real quick contest style exchange.
We'll be right back on QSO with our guest, Mike Thompson, WB8ERJ from Mansfield, Ohio, right after this. In this day and time, what we don't have much of is time. And if you enjoy operating and you just don't get a chance to, you need to take a look at the Trans World Antennas TW2010 and all the models that operate the different bands. Go to YouTube and put in Trans World Antennas and see how simple this thing is to set up. I mean, it is easy. It goes together fast. And of course, that gives you more time to operate. You're not fussing around with an antenna. In an emergency situation, it is absolutely necessary. You need to have one of these. If not for yourself, for your club, or whoever it is that may get called out on a scene where you've got to operate and you've got to be able to set up quickly and efficiently. Go to their website, and that's transworldantennas.com. Transworldantennas.com. There's a link up there to YouTube, and you can see how quickly this antenna sets up, how easy it is to operate. Transworldantennas.com.
If you're the decision maker for any form of outdoor lighting, you're going to want to listen to this. The Light Pack Systems induction lights, manufactured in the USA by a severely disabled workforce, uses a unique physical principle of light generation. This lamp system is therefore classified in a new family of sources, the Light Pack Induction Lamp Systems. Light Pack induction lighting is a breakthrough for professional, general, and special lighting applications. Not only because of its high luminescence and efficiency, but especially because of its unprecedented lifetime. System lifetime is rated at 100,000 hours, or about 20 years, based on 5,000 burning hours per year. With a failure rate of less than 10%. With this unmatched durability, LightPack offers substantial savings in direct maintenance costs as well as indirect costs. Induction lighting is relatively new in the United States, but it's proven technology developed in Europe over 20 years ago. Therefore, claims of durability is based on real-world empirical data as opposed to estimated design life provided by competitive lighting technologies such as LED. LightPack Systems was founded on the principles of green solutions for modern lighting through strong partnerships with the U.S. military, the University of Central Florida, and several national energy service companies. LightPack offers lighting solutions that provide a better quality of light with a 66% energy savings, also lasting up to 5 times longer than standard lighting options. LightPack's quality shines through with their standard 10-year warranty on all products. Call today for your free demonstration. Go to their website, lightpacksystems.com. That's lightpacksystems.com, spelled LitePackSystems. Lightpacksystems.com.
Are you needing a place to put up a website? Have you looked around? You want to do something that's easy, that's simple, and very, very inexpensive, but yet looks professional? Are you having troubles with your computer? Do you need some tech support help? Are you tired of being connected to India every time you pick up the telephone to get some help on a machine or on a website? The people to call is tux-support.com. That's tux-support.com. T-U-X, like tuxedo, dash support, the word support, dot com. These are the people to call. They can get you going. It won't cost you an arm and a leg. You can afford to work with these folks. They're professionals. They answer in plain English, and they can help you do things from a very, very basic, simple standpoint. If you have something that you want to do that's a complex project, well, they can handle that as well. But if you're like I am, when you're trying to put something up on the web or you need help with a computer, you really want somebody that speaks English. And you want it to be simple, and you don't want to have to pay an arm and a leg for it. And you want to deal with some good folks. Go to their website, tux-support.com. That's tux-support.com. At QSO, we've got a new prize closet, and we've got some interesting things going into that prize closet. Be sure and write us and send us that email that says, "I want to win." Put that in the text somewhere in that email and go to our website, QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com. And send us an email. Tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're listening, how the signal's coming in, or if you're listening by podcast. But be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because we're going to have some really, really neat things to give away. We'll be putting those things up on the website and telling you more about them on the air. Be sure and don't miss out. Send us an email and put in there, I want to win. Go to QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com or TedRandall.com, RANDALL, and we'll look for your email. And now back to our guest, Mike Thompson, WB8ERJ from Mansfield, Ohio, right here on QSO. So, in your activities, now, how much power do you run doing this? I mean, what is the typical?
I just use handheld, 2 to 5 watts. That's all I use.
Now, there are fellows that have the antennas that actually track the thing that are driven by, a motor drive of some sort. You know, what kind of advantage does that give you? Anything? I mean, does it extend your time any, or?
It doesn't extend your time any. It's, I suppose, one less thing to do, but honestly, I've never really, had one of those. I've just used my Aero antenna, and that's it. As a matter of fact, interesting thing, my first satellite contact was using a quarter-wave whip on the 2-meter mobile out of my van. And it was a horizon shot. I had about 40 watts, which I think is might be a little bit on the hot side, but in terms of ERP, I could have, I think, around 20, 25. But, I had a homebrew 70-centimeter antenna that I was able to receive, and I heard it, and I was really excited. And I just thought, let's just give it a try, and I just real timidly threw my call out there, and all of a sudden all these people started, hey, a new person, and, I was pretty much hooked. So, I mean, you really don't need much in order to get started into these satellites.
So what were you using? You were using 70 centimeters, and what, you 2 meters on the other side of it, or how?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Other than 2 meters and 440, what else is on the birds that you might want to consider using? Anything else, or are these is this the most common frequencies?
Yeah, this is most common. There's basically two classifications of satellites, and the ones that I work are what they call the easy sats, because they're easy to work. You don't need a lot of expensive equipment. You don't need a lot of fancy stuff. Pretty much, anything will work. That's just a basic 2-meter FM handheld will get you on the air. Now, a lot of these other ones that are, more fancier and stuff like that, to be honest with you, I've never really used. I take that back. Back in the early Oscar 11 days, many, many years back, I was at a friend's house, and I think that was probably my first experience with satellites, where they used transponders, and we were using CW. And that was more, you had a passband, what they call it. But that's a totally different thing. And, the easy sats, especially if you're wanting to get started, it's real easy to get started and get going and, enjoy the excitement of something fun.
Other than the satellites, I'm noticing some stuff up here that you've got about the, let's see here, what is it I was looking at? My MIR pictures via radio. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, that, when the Mir space station was up flying around many, 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 many years ago, and there's also, they also used to do this on the International Space Station, slow scan television. And that was very cool. Again, very easy to do. They had a 2-meter transmitter up on the Mir space station, as they do on the International Space Station. And they would send slow scan television pictures down from outer space. And again, that was very cool because all you did was took the audio from your 2-meter radio and fed it into your computer. And there's all kinds of different software out there that decodes the audio into the slow scan TV. And it's really quite amazing. I would know when the Mir space station or the International Space Station would go overhead when they were transmitting, and I couldn't wait to get home. And you know, it's like, you know, kid finding an Easter egg basket or something, you know, see what new pictures, you know, would show up on my computer. So,
okay, now how would you pick that? You pick it up directly from the space station as it passed over. So did you have like an antenna set up to track it, or were you catching it on a stationary antenna? How were you picking them up?
Well, I was, again, I tend to be pretty, in a sense, low tech. I guess I'm basically cheap, but my primary antenna was a what they call a turnstile antenna, and on the website there's a link about my turnstile antenna. It's slightly different than a normal turnstile antenna. I just used some 300 ohm twin lead for the elements, and made a phasing harness out of some coax and put some screen on the floor of my attic. And that's all I used for my antenna for catching space signals.
Okay, now, folks, listen to this for a second. Now, you non-hams out there. This fellow is building an antenna out of twin lead. This is the old-style television transmission line you used to use between your television set up on the roof and your TV that had the two screws in the back that you screwed the terminals onto. So he's making an antenna out of this and some screen. What kind of screen was it?
It's just regular window screen.
Window screen.
You got to make sure it's metal, but other than that, it's just regular old window screen you buy at the hardware store.
Well, here in Tennessee, we make all of our antennas out of that plastic screen. You know, that way we can't talk to anybody, but we're having a lot of fun. But no, go ahead. And now, okay, with this turnstile that you made, you've made a ballon of some sort with coax, and then you're feeding it downstairs to the radio with RG8U, RG850U, 58U. What are you using to feed the radio with?
Right. Well, since you're dealing with relatively low-level signals, you want to not have as much loss in the coax. RG58 is kind of frowned on a little bit, and I had some RG8 on hand, which even that is, in some circles, kind of frowned upon in terms of amount of loss for space communications. But, you know, on 2 meters, RG8 only loses 2.5 dBs for 100 feet. And I had 15 feet of coax. So, I mean, I was losing well under a dB in my coax, and I thought, I'm too cheap to go out and buy it, and I've got this. So I ran RG8.
Well, what would you use for low loss? I mean, would you make your own transmission line out of copper tubing? Or what would you?
I would say probably 213 or something like that. But I think that's what the guys will use. But you know, there again, I don't recall what the numbers are for RG213 in terms of loss. You might gain another dB or something of, you know, not as much loss in that coax. But you know, if you're running 100 feet up to your, you know, some tower or something like that, I could see it. But in my case, I was going from, you know, the second story of my ranch house that's up in the attic, you know, straight shot down into my basement. It was, like I said, 15 feet, so I wasn't concerned. And then I sprung for a preamplifier, which gave me like 20 dB gain. So, I mean, I had like full-scale signal, you know. Once the thing got about 15 degrees above the horizon, I was just full-scale on my receiver, so I had no problems picking
now,
up anything.
You fed this onto the... to a radio, and this is on what band, 440 or?
No, this is on 2 meters.
2 meters, okay.
Down around 145 megahertz.
And then the audio output, now is this on FM? Is it on sideband? What mode is this?
Yeah, it's FM.
Okay.
So you just need, just a regular old 2-meter FM handheld would work because you're not transmitting in this case. That's all you need.
Okay, now you're taking the audio output of this 2-meter rig. You're feeding it where to get the to turn this the signal into pictures? How are you doing this? Is it going into a computer? And if so, what software program or how would you process the audio to turn that into?
You just take the speaker out of your radio and run it to the line in of your computer. And then you get some software. Unfortunately, it's been a while since I've actually done this because they haven't really. Obviously, the Mir space station is in the ocean, and on the International Space Station, they really haven't done any slow scan television in several years, which is really unfortunate. But what was I going to say?
You were talking about software, and I guess you're going to tell
it. Yeah, software. So it's been a while in terms of what software I actually use. So honestly, I don't remember.
Let me ask you this question, and this is kind of off the track, but sure. is it possible to pick up video signals, direct from the space station? And intercept those and be able to watch the activities direct from the space station necessarily without having to go through NASA in order to do
that. Absolutely. I don't know what frequency it is. It's probably, 5 or 8 gigahertz or something. They have their own frequencies. But, yeah, guys do that.
I saw some pictures that some amateurs had taken, and I didn't know if it was an easy thing to do or if they encrypted the stuff or anything like that, because some of the pictures had anomalies in them that they said these were UFOs that NASA didn't want the public to see. But because we are amateur radio operators, can pick this stuff up direct. We were getting unedited versions of the video. So I kind of wondered about that a little bit. Thought I'd ask. Maybe maybe you've heard a little bit of this or something.
I've not seen it personally, but I know semi-regularly that the guys do watch the video directly. Now, again, the space station or whatever has to be directly overhead. If you're in the United States and they're over Australia, obviously you're not going to pick them up. But other than that, I know of guys that have, watched the direct video from, International Space Station.
I wondered about that on two counts, too, because we have, amateur radio veterans like Wayne Green. Are you familiar with Wayne at all?
Oh, absolutely.
And he says we've never been to the moon. So,
I don't know.
He says it was a conspiracy, that we'd never been there. And that,
I've heard that.
So
I tend to think we went personally, but
you think we went and you believe we went, and then you have this long conversation with Wayne, and when you hang up the phone, you say, I don't know, all the stuff he's presented. Of course, now he talks about eating raw liver a lot too, so.
Well, that might explain a thing or two. I don't know.
Maybe if you eat enough raw liver, I don't know. But no, he's amazing. The fella.
He's
up in years, and he is. He's just an amazing fella. I'm probably one of the most entertaining people I have ever put on QSO. But we'll be right back on QSO with our guest, Mike Thompson, WB8ERJ from Mansfield, Ohio. Right after this. How many of you would like to operate 80 meters, but you can't because of antenna restrictions? Well, that's over. You can operate 80 meters right now. You can operate from your home, your apartment. You can take it on the road with you. It's the brand new Transworld Antennas 8080. Go to their website and check it out, transworldantennas.com. This is a portable antenna. But it can be a permanent antenna. It's stealth. It's not a low-profile antenna. This thing is a performance-driven piece of engineering. You need to see it. It will be at Dayton, and you need to hear one of these on the air. If you want to operate 80 meters and you can't, I love the 80-meter band. I can't imagine not being able to operate on 80. But nonetheless, if you're in that position, don't stay in that position. Go to the website and check it out, transworldantennas.com. go up there and take a look at their brand new 8080 and look for it at Dayton.
Since the beginning of time and across the history of radio broadcasting, there's only one radio station that has ever earned a full-length documentary dedicated totally and completely to its rise to a pinnacle never before achieved by any radio station and its fall. This is a story of what happened when the most legendary programming genius of all time takes the reins of an obscure Canadian radio station in the small city of Windsor, Canada, and creates a radio legend that rocked the Motor City, the USA, and half a continent.
That does it for Big Tom Rivers, 1971, and Hank O'Neill starts a brand new year next at CKLW. For the last time this year, I will say to you, rock on, mother!
Ladies and gentlemen, the beat goes on.
CKLW.
2020 news guys, they were disc jockeys without music. Bum, bum, bum. And everybody knew that something was going to happen. You knew something was going to happen.
Motor City Mayor Roman Gribbs has a mad on for an unidentified rapist, a butcher knife-wielding pervert cornered a secretary in the elevator at Detroit City County Building and rode her to the vacant seventh floor and proceeded to sexually assault her. Guards are now being considered for future surveillance of the crime-stained seventh floor. Lee Marshall, 2020 News.
Now, Markham Street Productions takes you there as you relive the rise and fall of
the big HCKLW, the Motor City.
You can now own your own copy of this new DVD documentary, Radio Revolution, the rise and fall of the Big 8 from Markham Street Productions. The special edition DVD of this award-winning feature-length documentary includes extra scenes, outtakes, photos, and special features. Radio Revolution, the rise and fall of the Big 8 is now available for only $29.95 plus shipping. Go to RadioRevolutionDVD.com. That's RadioRevolutionDVD.com. Order now while supply lasts. RadioRevolutionDVD.com. That's RadioRevolutionDVD.com.
And the hits just keep on coming.
CKLW. Motor City.
If you're the decision maker for any form of outdoor lighting, you're going to want to listen to this. The Light Pack Systems induction lights, manufactured in the USA by a severely disabled workforce, uses a unique physical principle of light generation. This lamp system is therefore classified in a new family of sources, the Light Pack induction lamp systems. LightPack induction lighting is a breakthrough for professional, general, and special lighting applications. Not only because of its high luminescence and efficiency, but especially because of its unprecedented lifetime. System lifetime is rated at 100,000 hours, or about 20 years, based on 5,000 burning hours per year, with a failure rate of less than 10%. With this unmatched durability, LightPack offers substantial savings in direct maintenance costs as well as indirect costs. Induction lighting is relatively new in the United States, but it's proven technology developed in Europe over 20 years ago. Therefore, claims of durability is based on real-world empirical data, as opposed to estimated design life provided by competitive lighting technologies such as LED. LightPack Systems was founded on the principles of green solutions for modern lighting through strong partnerships with the U.S. military, the University of Central Florida, and several national energy service companies. LightPack offers lighting solutions that provide a better quality of light with a 66% energy savings, also lasting up to 5 times longer than standard lighting options. LightPack's quality shines through with their standard 10-year warranty on all products. Call today for your free demonstration. Go to their website, lightpacksystems.com. That's lightpacksystems.com, spelled LitePackSystems. lightpacksystems.com.
Are you needing a place to put up a website? Have you looked around? You want to do something that's easy, that's simple, and very, very inexpensive, but yet looks professional? Are you having troubles with your computer? Do you need some tech support help? Are you tired of being connected to India every time you pick up the telephone to get some help on a machine or on a website? The people to call is tux-support.com. That's tux-support.com. T-U-X, like tuxedo, dash support, the word support, .com. These are the people to call. They can get you going. It won't cost you an arm and a leg. You can afford to work with these folks. They're professionals. They answer in plain English, and they can help you do things from a very, very basic, simple standpoint. If you have something that you want to do that's a complex project, well, they can handle that as well. But if you're like I am, when you're trying to put something up on the web or you need help with a computer, you really want somebody that speaks English. And you want it to be simple, and you don't want to have to pay an arm and a leg for it. And you want to deal with some good folks. Go to their website, tux-support.com. That's tux-support.com. Here at QSO, we've got something new, and that's a prize closet. And we are in the process of filling that prize closet up. And we're going to be telling you on the air some of the items that we've got in the prize closet. If you'd like to win some of these things, we'd love to see you do that. But what you've got to do is send us an email. Go up to the website, tedrandall.com or qsoradioshow.com. And when you go to that website, just simply send us an email. Say hello, tell us where you're listening, how the signal's coming in. If you're listening by podcast, tell us how you have joined this radio show. And then put a little note in there that says, I want to win. And we'll put your name in the hat, and we will have a drawing twice a month, and we're going to be giving away what's in our prize closet. Now, I can't tell you everything that's in there so far, but we'll be posting those items up on the website, and we'll be telling you about them on the air, but don't miss out. Send us an email, and put in that email, I want to win. And let's see who the lucky winners will be. And now back to our guest, Mike Thompson, WB8ERJ from Mansfield, Ohio, right here on QSO. But I wondered about that because this, you know, one of the things I hate about amateur radio, worse than anything, and that is that once people get licenses, and I'm not going to say everybody, but a good portion, they tend to get a bit uppity and, you know, hyper technical, and they kind of like to show off that part of it, and they make things like what we're talking about sound so complicated that most people won't even start trying because they think, oh, man, you know, you've got to be a genius, you know.
No, you don't.
You have to understand the inner workings of an integrated chip in order to be able to do
Right. And for me, it's more a function of just being insatiably curious more than anything.
Well, I think that's what has always driven amateur radio.
Absolutely.
You know, and you think about what's come out of it. We wouldn't have modern-day cell phones.
Right.
A couple of hams developed TCP over IP.
Right.
I mean, ham radio has really impacted technically the entire world, and it's one of the most ignored hobbies in the world to have contributed so much to humanity.
Yep.
And that's what angers me when I hear about these neighborhood associations and all these goody two shoe prudes running home. We don't want one of those antennas in our neighborhood, you know.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's kind of like, well, wait till the power goes out for 2 weeks, lady.
And who do they run to? Yeah. Exactly.
And you can't figure out if Aunt Susie's alive or dead in that earthquake across the world somewhere, you know. You're going to be looking for that big antenna. As a matter of fact,
that's right.
The taller that antenna is, the better you're going to feel about knocking on the guy's door to ask if he can help you, you know.
So, exactly.
Well, what else are you into? Okay, now I think we've covered the satellite and the mirror pictures here, but you've got some other stuff that's interesting. What else are you into here?
Oh man, that's almost a problem for ham radio for me. It's like my ADD kicks in overdrive, and I'm just like, oh, this looks like fun, and oh, that looks like fun. You know, I really like CW. I like to you know, get down on 40 meters in the winter. Not so much now with the sunspot cycle activity, but you know, I like to you know, run CW and talk to Europe and different things like that. and contesting is fun, field day is fun. What do you want to do?
Well, you know, I guess the thing that I think we've really that's missing right now, and maybe it's just because of, you know, my generation or whatever, but I remember building one of the first things that it was built, a small Amico CW transmitter kit.
Yep, I remember those.
They go on eBay now for $5,000 or something. I don't know. But anyhow, I was a couple of tubes. Actually, I remember building a two-tube transmitter, one with just a rectifier and an oscillator, basically coupled, you know, with a crystal and whatnot.
Yep.
And coming home and going to my bedroom and flipping on the Hallicrafters receiver and getting on there, because I went ape crazy trying to collect QSL cards. And I didn't care where they were from. I wasn't trying to do worked all states or anything. I just wanted QSL cards.
Right.
And getting on and doing that, and I don't know, there was something about putting a homebrew transmitter on and operating that homebrew transmitter and getting those QSL cards. It was just, you become very obsessive about it. Matter of fact, I had problems going to school because I was... and I was like, I'm going to stay home.
Oh, Mom, I'm sick. Yeah. But 20 meters is open.
Uh-huh. But I think somehow we've lost that. We've really lost that. We're surrounded by all this technology, but it doesn't seem to be as magic. You know, I remember the first time I ever heard audio on a VHF amateur transceiver, and I don't know how old I was. I must have been maybe 12 years old, 13 years old, you know, and after listening to HF, I couldn't get over how amazingly clear it was. But then, back then, 2 meters, they were using a lot of the old Motorola two-way equipment, and it was a lot broader, you know. Yep. And it sounded high fidelity. It was impressive.
Oh, yeah.
And
especially after listening to, you know, sideband on 20 meters or 40 meters or something.
But even two-meter rigs today, the audio, I think, is notoriously horrible. I mean, it sounds clipped, it's pinched, it's restricted. You know, it just, they don't really take advantage of the... of the spectrum that's there, even though the spectrum is narrower than maybe than it was before, but you don't realize how good it could be, and I think that's one of the places maybe where we fall down a little bit, because I've heard audio on 2 meters that's so bad you can hardly understand what they're saying.
Oh, I know.
But what do you think about recovering the magic of the hobby, like what folks like myself experienced? Do you think it's possible to rekindle this interest, say, with solid state homebrew transmitters and slow speed CW for the ones that are just, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm just throwing something out, because one of the things I've noticed is when you get somebody on a CW frequency and they're just sending very slow because they're just getting started, they get blown away. I mean, it's like almost everybody on the frequency wants to show off how fast they can go just to further frustrate the guy. I've wondered about that a little bit, because it wasn't like that back when you had the novice, because there was always somebody worse than you, you know. And, you just had patience and you stuck in there with them, because it was all you wanted to do was communicate and get better. What do you think about that? You think that we're missing something, or am I just a curmudgeon?
Boy, I don't know what to tell you, Ted. I wrestle with the same thing. You've got this generation that you know, talking to somebody on the other side of the world is not that big of a deal. They've done it on the internet all their lives, you know. And when you and I were growing up, you know, ham radio in essence was the internet. You know, and I can remember going to school and people not believing me that I talked to somebody in Spain.
Oh, yeah. Well, the other thing is that what amazed me is the number of hams today that are on Facebook. You know, my son, Matt, came up with the idea that we needed to do a Facebook page for the QSO radio show. And I said, I don't know. I don't think we're going to find any hams up there. Well, we were up there 8 days and had something like 1,600 or 1,700 friends send friend requests, because I just went on the air and said, hey, if you're on Facebook, go up and send us a friend request. We don't want to look bad, you know. And so they went up, and I think it's QSO Radio Show is what it's under. And we had all
Well, I'll find you because I'm on Facebook, too. So there you go.
And but now I think now we're up to almost 4,000 friends. And I mean, and I click on some of the pictures. It doesn't look like it might be a ham. And a lot of them are foreign. I mean, they're from overseas and whatnot. And I'll click on them. And there they are sitting by their rig. And I'm thinking, my word, this is incredible. You know, and of course, every time I go up there, they've got two or three people trying to snag us in the chat room, and very seldom is it English. So I'm looking for Google's, what is it, Babbel or something, that where you translate back and forth. It's a slow process.
Yeah.
You know? But it is a little bit fun doing the translators and back and forth. But with the sunspot cycle having have been as low as it has been, I think a lot of people have turned to the Internet more for communications. But now the sunspot cycle is starting to come back. We're starting to see some activity.
Yep.
And I don't know. There's no substitute for that. That is the most exciting part of it. It's almost like, hey, I know the it's like calling someone on the phone. You can pick up the telephone and call Africa. I mean,
sure.
It's not a big deal. But there is something very magical about HF. And I remember doing a shortwave broadcast. This was years ago. We had a radio show on a shortwave station here in Nashville. And I remember getting a telephone call from a fellow in Cape Town, South Africa, and him holding the radio up to his telephone, and I could hear the music I was playing coming back over the phone. And
nice.
That gave me cold chills. I was like, I don't know, why would that do that? Why would you get cold chills? But it did. It was like, wow, this is cool. You know, of course, that station was running 100,000 watts into a rhombic antenna, so it was like, you know, not like ham radio, but it was just the fact that there really wasn't any physical connection between us and them, and it was just going through the air, you know, and that was just very cool. Of course, that's the way it works anyways, I mean, for amateur radio. Well, you like doing CW. Do you operate much HF at all?
When I do on HF, it's CW. I don't know, just like you say with the HF, there's something magical about, you know, running CW for me. I just have always been interested in that, and I do a little bit of phone, but not a whole lot. I don't have a high powered station. I only have 100 watts into a long wire, and for CW that's all you need. That's pretty much the story there. As a matter of fact, my first station, when I was in high school, I had like 800 watts, and I got tired. That was during one of the high sunspot cycle peaks in the 70s, late 60s, mid 60s, and I got tired of it. It became like talking on the telephone to me. You know, I got tired of talking to people in Europe. You know, and so I sold all my stuff and bought an old Tentec PM2A. Runs 2 watts on 80, 40, and 15 meters. And that held my interest for many, many years, just running, you know, QRP. So, again, it gets back to the mystique of the hobby. You know, once it becomes plug and play, it's almost like there's no challenge. But, you know, getting into the QRP side of it, it made it a challenge again.
Well, it has gotten all very much plug and play, you know, today. And some of that, I don't think, is because people, you know, don't have an interest in digging in. I think a lot of it has to do with time restraints. I mean, it's like I laugh and I tell both of my sons, I say, you know, we go to these ham fests and I always see something I have to have. And I pick it up and I bring it home and it sits on the shelf collecting dust, you know. And I mean, it's like there's no time, you know. So then when you do have the time, you know, you tend to be an appliance operator, you know, more than an innovator, which is really kind of sad. And I think that's a lot has to do with just society in general today. It's just how everyone's life is. You know, everybody doesn't have any time. You don't see relatives like you used to. You don't see friends like you used to. So it That kind of bears into it. Now, there's something I saw on your website that's interesting. You're talking about bicycle mobile.
Oh yeah.
Tell me a little bit about bicycle modal. That mobile. I mean, you must be a little multitasking in order to do that. So,
riding a bike's kind of like walking, you know. So if you can walk and talk on your radio, you can, you know, ride a bike and talk on it. But yeah, bicycle mobile, that's something that is enjoyable. I've got an antenna that I found out at an old QST magazine that uses an old bicycle flag pole, and then I run my HT in a handlebar bag with a mic, and just go down the road and you know, talk while I'm riding a bike. Now, usually when I do that, it's usually like on an organized ride, and there'll be hams along the way that other bicycle mobile hams. And but usually it's the bicycle mobile is really more a function of you know, in case there's an accident or somebody's broken down or something like that, you can call in and get some help. So there's like more of a public service aspect of it there, if you will.
Well, I've seen some guys run HF on a bicycle. That's why I was wondering if maybe you got into that a little bit at all.
No, I haven't. But there's this one bicycle ride that is a big bicycle ride here in Ohio that is 105 miles one way and then 105 miles back the other way on the second day. It's a two-day ride. But I did find this. There was this guy. He was a ham. He had what he called what's called a recumbent bicycle, and he had like this whole console of stuff. He had like 2 meters. He had a low band rig. He had like all kinds of antennas on his bicycle. That he was a low band, you know, riding his bike. Now, a recumbent bicycle is not like your regular bike. It's like you're sitting in a lounge chair, and your feet are like up in a recliner, but that's where the pedal part is. So it's kind of like a, if you will, a backwards bicycle. But yeah, I've actually seen guys that are going down the road on their bicycle, talking to somebody on 20 meters out in, you know, California.
I wondered about that. You know, I had seen fellas do that when I was younger, you know, and of course they were limited power wise. I mean, you couldn't run very much power off of a bicycle. But they had battery packs and they had their little generators that operated off the wheels and stuff. And I was amazed, you know, at somebody going to that kind of trouble and doing CW at the same time. So I don't know, riding a bike and doing CW, I don't have the brain power, you know. I mean, I'd run over the top of somebody or, you know, or drive into a pole or something. You know, I wouldn't be able
to. I'm with you, Ted.
But they do it quite naturally. Of course, that's the guys that, you know, they get so proficient at CW, they no longer hear characters. They're hearing words and sentences, you know, in their head as the stuff is being sent. Well, what got you interested in ham radio? What was it that sparked you to be interested in the hobby to begin with? What nailed you and pulled you into this?
Wow. That's a good question. I was always just this curious little kid, and I was always, you know, doing things, almost burning the house down by, you know, sticking things in the outlet, and just, you know, electronics always interested me. And you know, like I said earlier, I built my first radio in the fourth grade, and this was back in the old days of the night kit, where they had tubes, you know, 350 volts on the plate, and, you know, you got this 10-year-old that wants to build this radio with a soldering iron. parents today would, you know, totally not let their kids do such a thing. But my parents, you know, saw the wisdom or were foolish enough to let me do that. And, you know, I built my first radio, and I, you know, I was always doing stuff, you know, with electronics. And, you know, I discovered ham radio probably in the fifth grade, something like that. There was a neighbor down the road who had a ham radio, and he took me in and showed me a station. And, you know, I knew that's what I wanted to do. And I got a couple of books and this and that. And, it wasn't until probably, it was the ninth grade, 1967 64 that I actually got my license, but I mean, I was, and it was basically because of the math back then. I guess I was a little slow on the math side, but I got my license in the ninth grade, and it's as far as I'm concerned, it's the greatest hobby.
Well, you know, I guess you know what I felt because I was an only child, and my dad died when I was really young, so it was just my mom and I. But my room, when I walked into the room, it was like a gateway. You know, it was one of those stargates, you know, and on the other side was the entire world, you know, and you just never knew who you were going to talk to and make friends with.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the things that made the hobby so interesting. Now, a lot of that goes on the internet today. But it doesn't have something's missing there. I don't know what it is. Maybe it's because it's just too easy. You know, it's just too easy. In other words, it's easy to log on to onto Facebook and you go in and see who's online and click on a chat box and talk to somebody in Australia or Africa. And you don't really have much invested there, if you follow what I'm saying. You know, you don't have any, there's no, you know, you didn't build your own computer. You bought that at some computer store or online or at Walmart or something. And there's some internet provider giving you your internet access. You don't know how that works. You haven't got the slightest idea. Most folks can't even hardly configure their POP email account on their machine. A lot of them use AOL Mail because of that reason, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, but there's nothing invested. So there, when you actually sit down and build a transmitter and hang an antenna up in some trees, I think that's what causes it to be really magic, you know. And I also think, too, once a person passes a test, to me that gives Echolink and some of these other online things a lot more meaning. In other words, because they can get on and they can get on Echolink, but this still has to somehow be attached, you know, to ham radio. And I mean, there's a radio on one end or the other end, you know, and although I guess it's possible to contact people totally online, but you don't see a whole lot of that. I think the intrigue comes from utilizing the two-way radios. But there's something missing. So this neighbor of yours, now you said you saw did you see the antenna outside? Is that what drew you in by any chance, or?
No, actually it was a friend of mine was living next door to the guy, and it was a summer day, and the guy had a window open, and I heard all these sounds coming out of the window. I was like, what is that? And so the kid said, oh yeah, he's one of these ham radio guys. And I'm like, really? So yeah, that was probably even back before the days of air conditioning, otherwise probably the window wouldn't even have been open.
Well, you know, the thing that got me was across the alley from me was a fellow who put up a great big gigantic and I say it was gigantic because the thing looked bigger than his house. He lived in a small house, but it was a five element Long John Citizens band beam.
And,
he lived, I'm trying to think of the street he lived on. He lived one street over from me, so I guess he would have lived on Carlisle. It was in Dearborn Heights. And I went over and knocked on his door, and I asked him, what was this thing, you know? And he had me come in, and of course it was a Citizens band station, and I was really young. And he had a multi-LMAX Citiphone SS, but he didn't use call letters. He was totally 100% a bootlegger back then, and he used the handle, he used the handle Kingfish. And I think his name was McCavon or something like that. And I was real intrigued because they were talking Skip on this radio, and they had their own little hangout of people that hung out on one channel. And they were all friends. Yeah. I mean, they all had, but there was like an online community there. And of course, with 11 meters, you had that blend of Skip as well as local, you know, depending on the time of day. And then I remember not too far from me, down other ways, after exploring on the bicycle, you know, the neighborhood, there was a guy that had a cubicle quad up on a tower.
Uh-huh.
And the next door neighbor had a beam, you know, and I looked at those and I thought, now these look different than what this guy's got, you know. And so I engaged in conversation with them outside their home, and they told me, well, this is ham radio. Now, they didn't ask me to come in and look at anything. I mean, they just told me, this ham radio, and we talk all over the world. And the one fella had built the cubicle quad, So I still didn't quite understand what the difference was. You know, I mean, uh-huh. I didn't, you know, until my mom took me to a gentleman's house. He went to church with my aunt, I think, and his name was Nelson Cosby. Actually, I went back to Detroit, did an interview with him, and he took me down the basement and showed me this this Heathkit Marauder and this SX-101 and a Homebrew 813 amp.
And
And he had a beam up for 20 meters, and he made a contact with a guy in Denver. And once I saw it operate, that was it. I said, you know, this is, you know, because it, of course it looked like a spaceship the way he had everything set up. I mean, and a kid my age, a Heathkit Marauder looked giant. You know, it's this very big gigantic box with all these knobs on it. You know, and so that that got my interest. But now, did this gentleman ask you in? Did you get to go in and look at his station and talk to him?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Oh, absolutely. And he talked to somebody. It was more of a stateside contact, if I remember correctly, probably 40 meters or something like that. But, you know, still, just the intrigue with all the knobs and the dials and hearing the static. And, you know, there's something, if you will, romantic about it, for lack of a better term.
Well, I think that's an accurate description. Do you recall at all what equipment he was running?
No, I was too little.
Okay. Oh. Well, I understood. See, I saw all this stuff, and I had no idea what it was. But then as I began to get older, I began to say, well, wait a minute. I've seen that before, you know. And in my brain, I finally pieced together everything that he had. And when I went back to talk to him in Dearborn, we went and visited with him at his home. You know, of course, then he was kind of impressed that I had remembered all of this stuff. You know, I thought,
well, it is impressive.
But anyway, so he made a contact stateside. Well, did he kind of work with you at all, or where did you go from there? What was your next?
This is interesting because it's all coming back to me very interestingly enough. He had some old telephones, and he gave me the earpiece and the talk piece, and he showed me how to take a 6-volt battery and a bunch of wires and two sets of these and how to hook them up and make your own telephone. And so I was amazed. So I had this little tree fort out in the back, and I ran wires out in the back and, you know, did a little telephone in the tree fort and had one up in my bedroom. And my brother, you know, we talked back and forth on our homemade telephone, and we thought that was really cool, and that's, you know, that got the tinkering in me going. And then from there I went to the building of the night kit. I wish I knew. Oh, I can picture the radio in my mind. I wish I could remember what it was. A super regen receiver.
Let me guess, it was either that there was one called an ocean hopper.
I think that was it.
They had a big round dial on the front of it. That was
a region. That was it. Ocean Hopper.
Mm-hmm. And I think Hallicrafters had a small radio called the Sky Buddy or something like that. You know, there was a number of those. You know, but those little regens, boy, they were impressive. They could pull in some stuff. You know, they really.
Yeah.
Could. So, did you listen to any hams on AM back then?
That was right when SSB was coming in, and I can remember tuning down into the ham bands. And, you know, since the Super Regen didn't really have a BFO or anything, I couldn't really, you know, decode anything. So I couldn't really, I could hear a lot of, you know, hissing, you know, on-off hissing in the CW band and, you know, a lot of squawking. But I couldn't really hear any AM. There wasn't
hearing that stuff that sounded like that kind of thing going on.
That's exactly right.
It sounded like somebody didn't have their teeth in their mouth, you know.
Exactly. But it still intrigued me, you know, immensely, you know, the fact that this guy just down the road was, you know, talking to all these different places. And that, you know, my one birthday, I think it was when I was in seventh grade, I got the Heathkit R10 receiver. Does that sound familiar?
That's ham bands only, wasn't it?
Yep, that's right. That was green. Built that receiver.
It was green and had a broad dial across. They had the matching transmitter that went with it.
Yep, that's right. And then somebody gave me a transmitter, and that's pretty much all it wrote.
So Did you start off with a novice, or did you go right?
Yeah.
Okay. And how did that come about? Tell me a little about your study and test experience.
Well, you know, I had this receiver, and my mom, you know, obviously knew I was interested, and she found in a neighboring town an Explorer post, which is obviously part of the Boy Scouts, that all they did was ham radio. And so she got me into there, and Scoutmaster was a ham, and this was back in the day when they did have novices, and any ham above a general class could give the novice exam. Well, I studied real hard and, you know, passed my novice and got my novice license through that Explorer post.
How far, now where is Mansfield, Ohio located? Where are you? I think I know where you are, but I can't picture it for some reason.
Okay. Well, we're halfway between Cleveland and Columbus, Ohio.
Okay, now I know where that's at. The reason why is I'd spent quite a little bit of time in Ohio, and I remember Cedar Point, which was, do they still call it Cedar Point, or is it something else now?
Yeah, Cedar Point, that's in Sandusky, up on the lake.
So, but anyways, you know, Ohio, like Michigan, was pretty flat area. You didn't have a lot of big, you know, like we have here in Tennessee, we have a lot of hills, you know, so it's
right.
So repeaters tend to go a lot further in that flat country.
Yeah.
And you have, it's a little bit easier working. So I wondered where Mansfield was in connection with, if you'd ever been to, Greenfield Village in Detroit.
Matter of fact, I have a couple of times. Field trips with my kids.
I should say Dearborn, I guess. The reason why is when I was younger, I got caught bootlegging on the broadcast band.
Nice.
And but it turned out pretty good. The fellow that actually came to visit me from the FCC was a fellow by the name of Richard Cotton, who was noted for being a very stern radio engineer.
And he that name does sound familiar.
His call sign, I believe, I can't remember what it was. It was a simple call sign. Someone else has got it now. But anyways, what he did is he actually funneled a bunch of used equipment from some hams over to me. And I discovered it one day when I came home from school. And he encouraged these fellows from the Motor City Radio Club, which was at that time, and the reason why I ask is they met at Greenfield Village.
Oh.
And right in the museum, in the Henry Ford Museum, and they were right in the radio section.
Huh.
And at that time, the Henry Ford Museum had a ton of vintage radio gear. So if you can imagine going to these meetings and being surrounded by this, you know, it was, you talk about, you use the word romantic. This was incredible because there was all these old, and they had a ham station set up there.
Uh-huh.
Inside the museum itself.
Uh-huh.
And what a place for a radio club to have a meeting, you know. And I remember after seeing, you know, Cosby's station operate and then having these guys come and pick me up and take me to the meetings, that was really, I mean, I had no other direction to go in. I was totally 100%. I had been mainlined, you know.
Nice.
I wondered if you'd ever been there, because I know we made a recent trip and they had taken all the radio gear out.
Oh.
And I wanted to file a lawsuit. You know, because I thought, this is just nuts. I mean, because that was such a beautiful thing. And I remember all the gear they had. I mean, stuff at this point I don't understand, but I mean, they had all sorts of vintage radios and spark gap transmitters and just everything. Anything that was historic in terms of radio was there as well. And what a bunch of guys, too. Real friendly. Very much. It was like having 100 Elmers, you know. And they had their field day. I remember going to their field day a couple of times. But that got me started into it. So did you have a local radio club when you were younger? I mean,
that was this Explorer post. It was a very similar situation. It turns out that we met above a drugstore, and it was literally chock full of radio equipment, and it was all World War II surplus. As a matter of fact, if you go on my website, that 813 amplifier, that was the the one transmitter that was like our pet project, and I've ended up with it. But just all kinds of equipment like that, and I can remember, you know, once I got my license, our Explorer post, it was really quite hilarious. We were really a bunch of kids that were more into ham radio. I mean, none of us had any kind of uniforms. We didn't do merit badges or anything like that. As a matter of fact, like when we would go on camping trips, for us, camping trips was taking our gear, and we would spend hours, oh, whose rig are we going to, what kind of antenna are we going to do this time? You know, this and that and the other thing. And then, you know, the scoutmaster, he'd just sit back and let us go. And then he'd get a little practical with us. He's like, so, what are you guys going to do for tents? And we're just like, oh, just grab something and bring it. We're talking radios here, you know, and just that kind of a stuff. So that was, you know, for me, very beneficial, just to get, you know, all the excitement about, you know, doing this and that. And, you know, I can remember climbing up trees and cutting off the top of the trees and putting a Hustler antenna up at 50 feet, you know, just for fun and see how it works, you know, and just crazy stuff like that.
Well, the field days in Michigan were fun because I remember, even being young, that the guys had, they were out there. It seems like the Stroh Brewery Company came out and set up a thing, and they had kegs of beer on tap. Of course, nobody really got, you know, nobody got drunk or anything. It was just, it was on a warm day, you're doing field day. That was kind of cool.
Sure.
Now here in Tennessee,
sure,
most of the groups are teetotalers, you know, so that they don't have as much fun. They have probably, better barbecue, you know?
Okay.
But they're not there. Well, of course, I guess now some of them, they probably have things in their cooler that nobody knows about, you know. But anyways, that was always the thing up there. That was a very open thing, and the guys always had an awful lot of fun. But now the Explorer Post. What do you think the average age was that was attending the Explorer Post at the time?
Oh, we were all high school, 9th, 10th, 11th graders.
And what level of license did everybody have?
A lot of novices and some general class.
That was the pre-technician days at that time.
Well, no, actually, there was a technician. That my friend who was blind, he was a technician, and he was in that radio club too. So yeah, and I think that's when I got my advanced was when I was still in high school. I'm pretty sure of that.
Now, do you recall taking the test?
Which test?
For the novice, your very first license. Do you recall taking that test?
Yes, I do.
Well, tell us about that, because that's always an interesting story. Guys taking their very first test and getting the novice.
Well, I was nervous as all get out. You know, and there were a couple letters. I don't recall exactly which letters I was kind of stumbling on. But back then, you know, you would receive, you know, 5 minutes of Morse code at five words a minute. And what you had to do was have 25 letters in succession for one solid minute of copy. And I was so nervous. I couldn't even remember what the words were. I was so focused on just, you know, gotta get this letter, got this, you know. And I remember when I got done and looking at the piece of paper going, oh, there's no way, you know. I couldn't even recognize words or anything like that. And the guys, his name was Dick, and he was like, well, let's just take a look here. And you know, he starts counting the words, and he's like, oh, nope, you missed that one. So he started over again, and yeah, eventually, you know, he found 25 consecutive characters, and so I passed.
That's interesting, because then later that test was changed to, I'm trying to think now how they did it. In other words, it was no longer 25 characters in a row. It was then you had to pass a multiple choice. They sent you code.
Right.
Then you had to pass a multiple choice test asking you questions about what they just sent you.
Yeah. Now, that's an interesting story for me, because when I took my extra class, the reason I got my extra class, I don't know, 10 or 15 years, probably 10 years ago maybe, but maybe a little longer. But anyway, my biggest problem for not being able to pass my extra was the code was 20 words a minute. And I don't know if I'm left-handed or ADD. I can't write that fast. And when they changed it to where you would be able to copy 20 words a minute, solid, you know, code, or take the questions, I was like, oh, I'm in, you know. And but since Mansfield, Ohio, is kind of a smallish town, all the hands know each other, and I knew that I could not take it at Mansfield. And so I went to another town. I went over to Akron, and, you know, I walk in, and the guy looks at me, and he says, oh, so are you here for your no-code? And I'm like, oh, no, I'm here to take my extra. You know, and my first thought when he asked me if I'm here for my no-code was like, oh, this is perfect. They don't even know who I am. Nobody's going to even be watching me. There's going to be no pressure. So it was funny. I was the only guy taking the extra. And, you know, I love contesting. I copy stuff in my head. I don't write it down. And I can remember it was just me and the examiner sitting there, and it was a tape recorder, and you could adjust the volume and the frequency. And he hands me a piece of paper and a pencil, and I look at it, you know, and he turns on the machine, and I'm just sitting there copying the code in my head. You know, I close my eyes a little bit and just listen, you know, and it basically says, you know, this is the FCC test for extra class. If you have a problem hearing this, contact your examiner, blah, blah, blah. And I didn't even pick up the piece of paper and pencil, you know. And when it got done, I looked at him and said, okay, let's go. And I'll never forget the guy's face. He had this look on his face like, there's no way this guy's just not going to pass. So we kick on the code, and, you know, I just, all I did was do what I always do when I talk to somebody on CW, is just take notes. And I didn't even, you know, write anything down, and, you know, as far as letter per letter. And, turns out I passed the Morse code, and after the exam was done, the guy tells me, he's like, yeah, he says, we were taking bets on whether or not you were going to pass it or not, because unorthodox people, I guess, don't do it the way I did it. So that's kind of my story for passing my extra.
Well, you know, I've seen some folks. I lived in Saginaw, Michigan for a while, and there was a fellow there by the name of Earl Rosa. And Rosa has since passed, but he would take guys into the basement where he lived, and he would, you know, he'd physically show them what a capacitor was and a resistor, and you know, he just conducted tutoring, I guess is the best way to put it. And there was another fellow there by in Saginaw. His name was Ernie Blazer. He used to be WB8NDP. I think he's in Indiana now. And and these guys would work with CBers and whatnot, and because I had let my license go completely. And you know, from what I understand, you weren't allowed to take the novice over again or something like that. I don't remember how the rules went, unless the rules changed. In other words, once the novice was gone, it was gone for good.
Yeah,
and,
I think that's right.
And I thought, well, I'm not going to be able to retest unless I get my code speed up, and I don't want to just sit and practice. So. I got with Ernie, and Ernie gave me a novice exam, and I got another novice, and got on the air, got the code speed up, and then went ahead and, and passed the general and all that. And that was really cool. I wonder how many novice tests that Ernie had actually given to guys, because there was a lot of folks that were in CB radio that he had given the test to.
Oh yeah,
the novice test, you know, and every one of them, as I know today, is on the air, and is still doing ham radio. But, you know, guys like that are in such short supply, it seems like. Now, we've got a group here that does testing, a volunteer group. It's a VE team. And Butch Smith here in town is very, very active in this. I would have to call him the kingpin of it. And I don't know how many of these tests they do a year, but they really bring a lot of people into to amateur radio. And then they work with some clubs that are excellent. There's one in Williamson County, Tennessee here, that works with Boy Scouts and other things, and they're always doing something, you know, and they're just an excellent group. So it's always good. Now, in where you're at now, do you have a local ham group that you're involved in?
Yeah, the Inner City Radio Club, Mansfield.
Tell us a little bit about these scoundrels. Tell me about what you guys do. See, now they're going to get you because now I've said that, and they're going to say, "What did you say about us?" Now tell us a little bit about this radio group, and you have a repeater in town and whatnot. Tell us a little bit about what goes on there.
Okay. Well, we have a couple of repeaters, two on 2 meters and two on 70 centimeters, and basically, we have a club. We meet once a month, except for in the summertime and during field day. So, and we have our annual ham fest. It's not a big ham fest, but it's a good one. That meets in February, which is, pretty much on the leading edge of ham fest season, at least up here in Ohio. We have a meeting once a month, and we get together and just kind of, kick around ham radio stuff.
Do you have a net, and are you involved in ARES and any of that kind of thing?
I'm not really involved in the net so much. There is ARES and I'm on the list, if you will. I'm not all that involved in it, but
But they have activity in that
yeah.
club. There are those that are into that.
Yes.
Well, I wondered because it seems like we have a lot of interest. There's a lot of interest in the emergency communications, and I applaud those that are into emergency communications.
Absolutely.
And go down that road. Sometimes I think it may be overemphasized a little bit, and I think that folks come in contact with the emergency guys and somehow they feel that ham radio is not a fun thing, that it's everything is serious about ham radio, and that's one thing I kind of regret a little bit because I think that does detract from pulling in a lot of new people. They think, well, this is nothing, but these are people that do storm spotting and they chase after tornadoes and stuff, and that's just not the case, there are those that take it a little bit overly serious, I think. As an example, in our area, there's some 440 machines. I'd never operated on 440. Got my first radio that operated 440, and I got on a repeater. And the first thing I was told is, well, listen, the National Weather Service office is monitoring this machine. Now, the sky was clear. It was a sunny day. There was no danger, I was told, please get off this frequency because they don't want to hear people talk on it. Well, so I basically have stayed off of 440.
Yeah, that's too bad.
Completely. And we had some fellas, some blind guys that had gotten 440 rigs and got up, and those guys got ran off. So and recently at a ham fest, I was talking to a fella, and he said, well, that's a dual band. It's got 440. I said, well, that wouldn't do us any good. I said, because we don't operate any 440. You get run off of 440. And there were two or three guys there that was standing around and said, hey, that happened to me. That happened to me. So, I didn't feel so badly, that had happened. But sometimes, hams, we're not necessarily such a friendly bunch. We get cliquish and we get now. I love listening to the 75 meters and I love getting on 75. And when you got a friendly bunch of guys on 75, that band is very unique. Because you have a group of people that you get to know, and in a lot of cases, like in my case, had the opportunity to meet a lot of these folks and even go to their homes as I traveled across country.
Uh-huh.
And but then you have that same thing there where you have a group that becomes very cliquish. And I have a standing joke, and that is, you don't sound 85 years old. I've never talked to you before. Therefore, I'm going to pretend like I don't hear you. I hear there's a lot of that, there really is, and that's unfortunate as well.
Yeah,
because I think some of the fellows that's been around a long time, they have so much to offer and so many stories to tell, and so much they could teach the younger group, you know, if they would open up and do that.
Yep.
And when somebody comes on a frequency, I mean, I've actually heard on 75, I've actually heard guys get on and say, well, that guy there, he's a no-code general.
You know,
I've heard this, you know, and it's like, why? Why? What is that all about? You know, I mean, so...
It's like they're not real hands or something.
Right, and it's kind of like I'm saying, okay, then maybe it ought to be the other way around as well. Maybe the guys that say you have to know code to get the test, maybe those guys ought to be able to accurately define a subnet mask before they can get their license, okay? I mean, you know, what's good for the goose is good for the gander.
Sure.
The other thing is that we did a broadcast, I think it was from Huntsville, and we were on the air live from Dayton, and I had a chance to talk to quite a few folks, and Gordon West being one of them. And Gordon said since they lift the code restriction, after it's been lifted, that his code practice tape sales went right straight through the roof. You know, he's selling all kinds of CDs on code practice. And the same thing from the former owners of Vibraplex. They said that they have done more business since the code restrictions have been lifted than they ever had in history. So sometimes I think that I think actually what they did is they made CW more intriguing, you know, more more romantic, you know, more you know, more special, you know, rather than using it as an obstacle. Now I think we actually have more people that are really in love with CW, embracing it as a mode of communications and learning it and as an art form even. Then we did when it was like, hey, you got to learn this, because a lot of people would learn it just enough to get past the test, and then that was it. I want nothing else to do with that stuff, you know.
I'm
going to bury the code key in the backyard, you know. So, and I think that's helped a lot. Tell me, is there anything else that you're into that you want to talk about, something that intrigues you that we've missed here in this conversation?
Oh, boy. Well, you know, like I say, there's so much. There, a lot of the digital modes intrigue me. They got that HSMM out there with internet, something like that.
I'm not familiar with that, but tell us about that.
I don't even know. I just read it in passing, and I don't know if it's come and gone, but it's basically 2.4 gigahertz, like Wi-Fi. There are certain channels that are in the Wi-Fi band that are actually in the 2.4 gigahertz ham band. And so instead of only running 100 milliwatts on your wireless router, a ham can legally run, if they're licensed for this, as in an extra, for example, can legally run 1,500 watts on certain channels of the Wi-Fi.
So that would really open the door up to being able to work, computer to computer, I guess, and to do some things like that.
Well, yeah, and it could even, you know, open the door to a lot of computer guys that are, you know, so sucked up into the internet that want to tinker with more digital stuff.
We'll be right back on QSO with our guest, Mike Thompson, WB8ERJ from Mansfield, Ohio, right after this.
If you like to travel, if you're a camper, if you'd like to take your ham radio hobby with you when you go, you need the Trans World Antennas TW2010L Backpacker Antenna. It's the same exact antenna as the TW2010 Adventurer, with the exception it's been streamlined for the person who likes to camp and travel light. It's the same rugged antenna structure as the TW2010, with the black powder coating and stealth design. We all know the TW2010 is a great permanent or portable antenna, but the TW2010L Backpacker takes portable and emergency operation to an entirely new level. It's especially suited for the amateur operator who loves backpacking, cycling, camping. It makes easy access and quick setup possible for the most extenuating emergencies. TW2010L Backpacker Antenna is available now for a limited time for only $399.95. $399.95. That's right, $399.95. Pricing includes backpacker, quadra stand, carrying bag, and free shipping in the continental United States through FedEx Ground. That's transworldantennas.com. And now for a limited time, only $399.95. That's transworldantennas.com.
If you're the decision maker for any form of outdoor lighting, you're going to want to listen to this. The Light Pack Systems induction lights, manufactured in the USA by a severely disabled workforce, uses a unique physical principle of light generation. This lamp system is therefore classified in a new family of sources, the Light Pack induction lamp systems. Light Pack induction lighting is a breakthrough for professional, general, and special lighting applications, not only because of its high luminescence and efficiency, but especially because of its unprecedented lifetime. System lifetime is rated at 100,000 hours, or about 20 years, based on 5,000 burning hours per year. With a failure rate of less than 10%. With this unmatched durability, LightPack offers substantial savings in direct maintenance costs as well as indirect costs. Induction lighting is relatively new in the United States, but it's proven technology developed in Europe over 20 years ago. Therefore, claims of durability is based on real-world empirical data, as opposed to estimated design life provided by competitive lighting technologies such as LED. LightPack Systems was founded on the principles of green solutions for modern lighting through strong partnerships with the U.S. military, the University of Central Florida, and several national energy service companies. LightPack offers lighting solutions that provide a better quality of light with a 66% energy savings, also lasting up to 5 times longer than standard lighting options. LightPack's quality shines through with their standard 10-year warranty on all products. Call today for your free demonstration. Go to their website, lightpacksystems.com. That's lightpacksystems.com, spelled LitePackSystems. lightpacksystems.com.
At QSO, we've got a new prize closet, and we've got some interesting things going into that prize closet. Be sure and write us and send us that email that says, "I want to win." Put that in the text somewhere in that email and go to our website, QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com, and send us an email. Tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're listening, how the signal's coming in, or if you're listening by podcast, but be sure and put on that email, "I want to win," because we're going to have some really, really neat things to give away. We'll be putting those things up on the website and telling you more about them on the air. Be sure and don't miss out. Send us an email and put in there, "I want to win." Go to QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com or TedRandall.com, RANDALL, and we'll look for your email. And now back to our guest, Mike Thompson, WB8ERJ from Mansfield, Ohio, right here on QSO.
You know, I just read the other day where Linksys routers are Linux-based, and so Linux being open source, you have to publish the code. And so a lot of guys have gotten a hold of that and literally modified the firmware of Linux routers and done some pretty interesting things. And I was just reading the other day where on Wi-Fi you've got 11 channels, channel 1 through 11, obviously. And apparently what you can do, there's a and I kind of hesitate even saying this, but and I've only done casual looks on internet about this, but apparently there's some firmware out there that allows you to go below channel 1, and I think they call it channel 0 or channel minus 1, which are away from the traditional Wi-Fi channels but still in the 2.4 gigahertz ham band. So that then allows us hams to do high-powered, high-speed digital mode. Sounds very intriguing to me.
That's interesting. And I've often wondered about, and I've mentioned this before, and people said, "Well, this has already been done. We've got this and this and this." But I've often wondered why we haven't actually built a network that is separate from the internet, but actually operates like the internet, that is a ham based thing. You know,
that's, well, that's from what I'm reading, and again, I've not done this, but it sounds very intriguing to me. This sounds like this could be it.
Yeah, you know, you just wonder what the future holds. I mean, you know, back in the days of AM, when it was just AM and there was no single sideband, it's very difficult to imagine at that point what people are doing now. And,
absolutely.
So now I guess we're in that same position. I guess it's very difficult for us to imagine what's going to be around the corner, you know, what's going to be available in another, say, 20 years. You know, I mean, it's scary to think, you know. It really is scary to think. But that's interesting. You know, now have you done any much in regards to the other, I mean, some of the things like D-Star? Have you played around with that at all?
No, I haven't.
Okay, there's D-Star. There's another system a friend was telling me about. I can't remember what the name of it is offhand. He prefers that over D-Star. Other guys prefer the D-Star. And then there's, of course, there's things like WinLink, you know, which is and all of these things. Now, but what other digital modes are you looking at, or what other digital modes have you got into, or have you done any operating in that arena?
Well, see, I got into packet radio when that got started. That was a long time ago. Done a little bit of APRS and different things like that.
Well, the APRS is fascinating.
Yes, it is.
And I talked to a friend of mine here not too long ago that told me that has now, that the amateur radio operators messing around with that is what has led to a lot of these little tracking devices. Like right now, you can actually order a little unit that you can put on your dog.
Yep.
You know, and as the dog, if a dog wanders away from home, he can be tracked right on your computer with a little device about the size of a pack of cigarettes.
Yeah,
and supposedly, from what I understand, that it was ham technology that led to the development of those devices. Have you ever seen one of those things?
No, I haven't, but I've heard about them though.
And I can't think what the name. I know what they're called. They're called Zoomback or something like that. I saw a web page on it, and I thought that was very, very interesting, because I mean, if somebody kidnapped your dog and took him to Hong Kong, you could still track the dog. You maybe wouldn't be able to get to him, but you would have some idea what part of the earth he was in.
Yeah.
So, well, you know, I'll tell you, I've enjoyed the conversation with you. I don't want to keep you too long. I always enjoy talking to folks like you, because you know, you're truly interested in the hobby. You've got a lot of a lot of high power interest in so many different things, and you're kind of hands on. You like getting in there and playing with things, and you put everything in simple terms, which I think is so important. You know, I think one of the worst enemies we have is making things overly complicated.
Absolutely,
and we scare people away with that. You know, they think, "Wow, it's too. I could never do something like that." You know, and really, that's just not the case.
Right.
You are. Tell me. You are affiliated with the American Radio Relay League. I assume you're a member.
Yes.
Is the club affiliated with the ARRL?
Yes.
Okay. Do you participate? Does the club itself have its own field day?
Yeah.
Are you combined? Well, how do you guys? In closing, let's talk about that a little bit. Tell me a little bit about your ARRL affiliation, and tell me a little bit about your club's field day activities.
Well, I'm a little confused about the ARRL affiliation. What you mean, my own personal?
Well, you're a member, but I mean, I guess my question is what is it about the league that intrigues you, or what do you enjoy doing, or how do you affiliate with the league? I mean, maybe you just read QST. I don't know.
That's pretty much it. I read QST. It's a great magazine.
I didn't know if you might participate in any of the contests and, or if any of the other activities that they have. I know Field Day is the big, you know, the big thing, you know, every year.
Field Day is a big one, and I've run sweepstakes a couple of times and different things like that. As far as our club, we have a little trailer that's an AR It's an emergency command post, if you will. It's got all kinds of radio gear, and we have a I think it's a 20 kilowatt generator, and that's how we run field day. You know, we set up tents and then set up our antennas and stuff.
Where do you do this at?
The location varies. Sometimes we've done it out at one of the fire stations. I think he's the fire chief. There's some kind of muckety muck in the fire department is a hand. There's several of them that are that. So we get to park on out behind one of their fire stations. We've done it at right in the middle of the high school football field. We've done that. You know, just various places out at the local area mall. We've done that. You know, kind of to stir up interest in ham radio.
So these folks in your area there, they'll just point out, say, oh, there's those crazy guys again. They're set up out in the middle of the football field this time. What are they doing out there? You know.
Yep, that's right.
Tuning up a goalpost is what they're doing.
For sure.
So anyhow, but you guys, you do participate in field day. Do you have a field day chef that cooks, or do you is it bring your own, or how?
No, we have a field day chef that cooks, and I'm afraid some of the people come out just for the food. But that's part of field day, though. You know, for the food and just hanging out for the camaraderie.
Well, I'll tell you, one of the most fun things in the world, we broadcast live on Field Day, and we have people calling in from everywhere, and one of the most fun things is to ask them what they're eating for dinner, you know. And,
there you go.
Oh, man, you hear some stuff, it just kind of blows the mind, you know. some of these people, they just blow it right out on Field Day. They've got the chef out there, and they're cooking up all kinds of things, you know. So that makes it all that much more fun. Do you have a pretty good turnout, though? Does the public come out and watch you guys operate?
Not great. We probably have, Mansfield isn't that big of a town, but we probably have maybe a dozen people come out. So, which, for a town our size, I guess, isn't too bad. You know, if we're in a more public area, like, around a mall or something like that, people kind of will naturally wander over. So
I think the best thing to do around Field Day is to start a rumor, that they're going to have such and such out here in the middle of the park, the most outrageous, they're making contact with an alien civilization or something.
Nice.
that'll bring them out, Either there that you or go. You put up a sign that says free food, of course, then you get a lot of takers, But I think it's good when you do things in different parts of town, you are attracting attention, and folks are learning a little bit about the hobby. And even if only a dozen people show up as visitors, that's still... they have an interest, and especially if you have one of those stations that people can sit down and kind of operate to and see what it's all about. That's an excellent thing. Well, listen, thank you so much for joining me. I appreciate you taking the time, and I want folks to go to your website and check that website out, and that is let me make sure I get the call sign right. WB8ERG.com, Whiskey Bravo 8. And what phonetics do you use?
Echo Radio Japan.
Oh, you're using conventional phonetics, okay. So some guys get real creative with the phonetics. So is it W?
I didn't. I'm not creative that way.
So nobody's ever hung one on you, hung a set of phonetics on you that were funny and almost embarrassing then at this point.
Well, yeah, they have, but let's just keep them there.
Okay. Yeah, I've had a few of those. They're fun. They're fun.
Oh, yeah, they are.
But thank you so much, Mike. I appreciate your time, sir, and look forward to meeting up with you on the air sometime.
That would be great.
Here at QSO, we've got something new, and that's a prize closet. And we are in the process of filling that prize closet up. And we're going to be telling you on the air some of the items that we've got in the prize closet. If you'd like to win some of these things, we'd love to see you do that. But what you've got to do is send us an email. Go up to the website, tedrandall.com or qsoradioshow.com. And when you go to that website, just simply send us an email. Say hello, tell us where you're listening, how the signal's coming in, if you're listening by podcast. Tell us how you have joined this radio show. And then put a little note in there that says, I want to win. and we'll put your name in the hat, and we will have a drawing twice a month, and we're going to be giving away what's in our prize closet. Now, I can't tell you everything that's in there so far, but we'll be posting those items up on the website, and we'll be telling you about them on the air, but don't miss out. Send us an email and put in that email, I want to win. And let's see who the lucky winners will be. Well, that's all the time we've got for QSO today. We invite you to tune in again, same time, same station, for QSO. Special thanks to our guest, Mike Thompson, WB8ERJ from Mansfield, Ohio. Once again, thank you for listening to QSO.